This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's day 17 of the government shutdown, the second longest shutdown in U.S. history. Some TSA workers are reportedly calling out sick because they can't afford to get to work, and many government agencies, including the EPA, NASA, and the National Weather Service, are not active. But government employees aren't the only ones affected by the shutdown. For thousands of immigrants and asylum seekers awaiting their day in court, the shutdown has presented yet another obstacle. Hearings that were scheduled to take place over the past 2 weeks have been postponed indefinitely, and that leaves many people in limbo and adds to the already extensive backlog of cases. Gagi Otiasvili is one of them.
What happened? Russia bombed my house one time. They attacked several times in my country.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, the Eastern European country of Georgia gained its independence. But tensions between Russia and Georgia remained. Otiasvili worked for the Georgian government at the time. In August 2001, Otiasvili fled Georgia and arrived in New York to apply for asylum.
My process was taken in a legal way. Never I was hiding from the government. As a former government worker and statement, I never have any intention to do anything unlawful.
Otiasvili married a U.S. citizen and built his life in the United States. All the while, he was waiting for his day to stand before a federal immigration judge. And after 17 years, he finally got a notice.
A court hearing was appointed January 2nd. Everybody knows this could be a final listening. They think everything could be good.
His final hearing. And then the years-long process would come to an end. But then the government shut down.
Because this court was shut down, we don't know when court going to give another new data.
And his January 2nd hearing was canceled. Now again, he must wait. And the backlog in the immigration courts is already years long.
So we now have about 60 courts across the country and about 400 immigration judges, but our backlog is well over 800,000 cases and growing. If you count the cases that the Attorney General in his recent decision stated he wanted to put back on the docket, that would take us to well over 1.1 million backlog cases.
That's Ashley Tabador, a federal immigration judge who spoke to us on behalf of the National Association of Immigration Judges. Tabador is the group's president. Of the million cases that are currently in the backlog, a large majority are for immigrants who are not currently detained. Many have followed all the laws and are awaiting a decision from a judge.
For the non-detained docket, all of the cases have been canceled. So every day, thousands and thousands of cases that had previously been scheduled are not being heard.
And that's being exacerbated because of the government shutdown. So for people like Gagi Otiasvili from Georgia, that means his case could now end up at the back of the line.
When a case is not heard, when you have something like this shutdown and the cases are being canceled, it isn't like you can just turn around and roll over 4,000 cases and tell everyone magically to just show up, you know, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later. No, you have to now find a place for the cases that were not heard, which means that it's likely going to go to the back of the docket. So those individuals are now going to have two or three or maybe much longer periods of delay, or you're going to have to bump other cases.
And for the immigration judges, the shutdown means they're working for free.
First of all of our judges are now in a non-paid status, so no one's getting paid. This past weekend, we were supposed to have a paycheck, and no one has received one as far as I know.
And as court hearings get canceled, the backlog is getting bigger and bigger.
Because our judges, particularly the ones who have the non-detained docket, have thousands of cases individually that they're responsible for. I have somewhere about 2,500 cases the last time I looked. And I have colleagues who have upwards of 5,000 or 6,000 cases on their docket. So it's not unusual for judges to have cases scheduled on their docket up to 2, 3, or 4 years ahead of time.
Joining us to discuss all this is Greg Chen. He's the Director of Government Relations for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Greg, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
So let's take a broad look across the country. When it comes to the immigration courts and the government shutdown, what are we seeing?
What is most dramatic, as the example of the story of Mr. Otiashvili shows, is that the president's shutdown is jeopardizing the lives of asylum seekers and other immigrants who have been waiting often for years for their cases to be resolved. And what that means is that asylum seekers who are worried about their lives and that they could still be sent back to dangerous conditions in their home countries, they're still waiting in limbo. And evidence in their case could go stale. Witnesses who are going to provide declarations and information showing the persecution and the violence that these people have suffered could be lost. And so the shutdown is really making the courts not operational at this point, and lives are going to be affected. People are really going to be hurt by this.
What about attorneys? How are they handling the situation? I mean, do they understand how this shutdown is affecting their clients?
Well, we are still trying to figure that out. And with 15,000 immigration lawyer members across the country, what we are hearing from our members is that they're having their cases be delayed and taken off the docket. And as Judge Tabador described, you know, the vast majority of cases in this backlog of more than 800,000 cases now, possibly more than a million if all the additional cases are added, as the administration has planned to do, those vast majority of cases, those are the ones that are sitting on the dockets in the non-detained calendar. These are people that are not in detention of any kind. Those cases are being pushed off, and they will have to wait typically more than a year. In New York, we're talking about probably not having your case go back on until 2022 or the year 2023. That's a few years out. And attorneys are still trying to figure out what to do to make sure these severe delays don't hurt their clients.
As we mentioned in the introduction, there is a severe backlog of these cases even before the shutdown happened. We interviewed Judge Ashley Tabador, who was with the National Association of Immigration Judges, and she told us the following.
We need to remove the immigration court from the Justice Department. The backlog that we're seeing now and the dysfunctionalities that we're seeing now all stem from the fact that we have an immigration court run by a prosecutor. So it is absolutely indefensible to have a court that has that ability of a prosecutor to interfere and intercede and use the court for law enforcement perspectives and policies. You can't have the executive branch be responsible for the enforcement of the law as well as adjudication of claims that are brought as a result of the enforcement of those laws.
Greg, your thoughts on that. Is Judge Tabador correct? Is the lack of independence for immigration courts partly to blame for the backlog?
AILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, does agree with the position that the immigration courts can no longer be part of the Department of Justice controlled by the Attorney General. And it's true that the backlog of cases was already very large before this administration took office, but policies that the Trump administration has implemented, particularly under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and his successors seem to be taking the same approach. Those policies have made it worse. They are literally preventing the courts from being able to operate efficiently, and they are literally hamstringing judges from being able to manage the dockets so that they can take the cases that are requiring more urgent review so they can make those decisions appropriately in a timely manner. They're holding those up. And what's happening is that we are seeing that due process for asylum seekers, constitutional rights are being affected here.
But Greg, do those folks have any recourse given this shutdown? I mean, or is it really just a question of wait and see, and we've got about 30 seconds left?
Well, the policies of the administration are being challenged in the courts now, especially decisions that will directly limit the right of asylum seekers to be able to get fair review of their cases. Those are going to be challenged by lawyers in the courts. We will make sure to stop this. The Constitution protects the rights of asylum seekers who are seeking protection in the courts. And if the courts can't operate properly to guarantee that, that is just not the American way.
Greg Chen is the Director of Government Relations for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This November, Floridians voted to give more than a million convicted felons the right to vote. Voter registration opens tomorrow for convicted felons who've completed their sentences, but there's been confusion about whether the amendment can go into effect immediately or if more legislation is needed. Governor-elect Ron DeSantis, who will also get sworn in tomorrow, says the amendment requires a new state law before it's executed. Advocates disagree and say rights should be fully restored as planned tomorrow. Here to walk us through some of the confusion around the voting measure is Daniel Rivero, a reporter and producer at WLRN in Miami. And he's joined by someone on the front lines of this, Wesley Wilcox, the supervisor of elections for Florida's Marion County. Welcome to you both. Daniel, let's start with you. Can you give us a sense of what does this constitutional amendment mean for former felons?
Basically, Florida was one of the only three states that permanently disenfranchises people who have been convicted of a felony for life, unless they go through this arduous rights restoration process, which under recent years, under our current outgoing governor, Rick Scott, basically very few people in any given year were actually restored those rights. So the voters signed petitions, they put this on the ballot, and it was passed. It was overwhelmingly passed. So overnight, on paper, tomorrow, on January 8th, all these people are supposed to have the rights restored. They'll be able to start voting in mayoral elections, Senate elections, the governor election.
But Daniel, this sounds pretty straightforward. Why is there so much confusion?
The fact that it's overnight and this was passed and this is going into effect on paper before the legislature even comes into session is really where a lot of the confusion is around this. There's a lot of confusion about the definitions. You know, one of the things in the amendment is any felon who has completed all the terms of their sentence gets their rights restored. But now the question is, well, what does that mean? How do you know if someone's completed the terms of their sentence? Is that after they've finished their probation? Is it if you owe court fees? Is that considered part of your sentence? I've talked to supervisors of elections, clerks of courts, people up and down the state. There's no cohesion on this. You know, some people say, like here in Miami-Dade County, we have a supervisor of elections, Christina White. Her office said late last week, you know, we're ready to register people. But then you talk to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which has a hand in this because they're the ones that actually determine things as far as criminal justice. They keep a lot of that data. They've told me they can't do anything until the legislature passes something. Now, the problem is the legislature doesn't meet for two more months. So even if they tackle it immediately, you're going to have a gap where there's a lot of questions of definitions.
This sounds like a big mess. Wesley, you run voter registration in Marion County. Does this new amendment cause confusion from where you're sitting, from your perspective?
I really don't believe it does, because starting tomorrow, if a voter, regardless of their felony status, if they've completed the sentence and done all that, and they come in and complete this form, check box two, which is the box kind of in question. If they check that box, they're a registered voter, in my perspective.
We spoke to State Senator Dennis Baxley about this issue last week, Wesley, and he obviously, as you know, he heads the Florida State House's Ethics Committee, and he has an interesting view on the matter. Let's take a listen to what he has to say.
My biggest concern is I don't want 67 actually supervisors of election all coming up with their own way that they validate this person as being eligible. And particularly when you're talking about potentially 1.5 million people.
Wesley, what's your response to that? Is it possible that you and other election supervisors could do things differently?
I doubt it. You know, with all due respect to Senator Baxley, as a supervisor of elections, if a voter completes this form and presents it to us, whether it be in paper format, online, however they complete this form, and they check that box, box number two, and let me read you number two real quick, and it says, I affirm that I am not a convicted felon, or if I am, my right to vote has been restored. If a voter completes and checks that box and down at the bottom where they sign it, and there's an oath down at the bottom that says, I do solemnly swear or affirm, so on and so forth, and that all information provided in this application is true. If a voter completes this form, signs this form, and provides it to me, we're going to process that through. And I believe all 67 of us are going to process that through virtually identically.
Daniel, I want to ask you a question here. The ACLU and other groups are saying that this delay essentially will counter the will of voters. And we've seen other ballot initiatives that are passed in Florida. Sometimes, you know, they think things will go into effect immediately and then politicians step in and delay the process. Do you see that as happening on the ground right now, Daniel?
Well, there's certainly a sense that there's a sense of frustration and a little bit of anxiety pointing to that, you know, potential reality. I mean, we will really find out tomorrow. Now, from the people I've talked to, this is likely to they've told me that this is likely to come to a head in the city of Tampa. They have a mayoral election in early March, just as the legislature is actually meeting. And it's a big deal. It's one of the biggest cities in the state, in one of the biggest states in the country. And you're having a mayoral election. If you were to tomorrow go and register to vote, you would be eligible to vote in that election.
I wanted to bring in one more statement here from State Senator Baxley, Wesley, and get your thoughts on it.
I'm going to get accused of voter suppression and all these things. And in fact, it's very clear that it's just trying to make government work well. We're going to implement this. We're going to implement it timely, and we're going to improve it.
Wesley, your thoughts on that as somebody who's going to have to be part of that implementation?
The statement is, we're going to implement this. I believe that's 100% accurate. You know, if a voter walks into my office, an office in Tampa, and they complete this form and provide it to the supervisor of elections, we're going to register that voter, and they're going to be a registered voter the following day. And so they'll be eligible for the upcoming spring mayoral elections or any other type of election that's upcoming. So it's going to be implemented, and actually, you know, people talk about it being tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. or whatever else. In the state of Florida, we have online voter registration. So I highly suspect that there will be people at 12:01 a.m. this morning here in just a short few hours becoming registered voters. So welcome to registration.
Wesley Wilcox is an election supervisor in Florida's Marion County, and Daniel Rivero is a reporter and producer at WLRN. Thanks to you both.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
At the hairdresser, in the doctor's office, and on the newsstands, for decades, women's magazines were there. The glossy pages of Redbook and Shape and Glamour for women to skim and, in some cases, swear by. Growing up, these magazines featured women that didn't exactly look like me, with clothes and beauty products that I really couldn't afford, but they gave a voice to issues that women cared about, and often they were also written by women journalists. Many of you, our listeners, have similar stories to share.
Regarding women's magazines, they used to make me feel like a failure, despite the fact that I'm 5'6 and a half and weigh about 132 pounds. Now, I simply ignore them. My name is Mary. I live in suburban Philadelphia.
I love them. I love all the new products that they represent, the clothing, the women wearing new trendy things, new ideas to make my life simple.
This is Nancy in Dallas. I got a lot of good information from women's magazines over the decades. Now that they're digital, I don't read them anymore.
What Nancy brings up is important for some of us. In a changing media landscape, women's magazines are changing as well. And January is the last month that readers will be able to buy a print copy of Glamour magazine. That's after more than 80 years in publication. Teen Vogue, Redbook, and others have already shifted to digital-only formats, and titles like Lucky and Ladies Home Journal have even folded in recent years. So what does this mean for women readers of all ages who've relied on these glossies for so long? Well, I've got two women with me now who know a thing or two about this industry. Samita Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue. Thanks for joining us, Samita.
Thanks for having me.
And Vanessa DeLuca, who was the editor-in-chief of Essence from 2013 to 2018. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you.
So I cannot tell you, well, I have told you how excited I am to have both of you here, goddesses of print glossy magazines. Let's start with the news about Glamour. I'm actually stunned. I saw it go through this shift. It got like a new font and it started looking really different. And now all of a sudden, it's gone, Vanessa, or it will be gone. You started at Glamour. What was Glamour like back in the day?
Well, back in the day when I was there with Ruth Whitney, it was like a bastion of women's journalism. You know, all kinds of amazing voices were featured. The fact that you know, Ruth Whitney had the foresight to cover politics long before a lot of other publications were doing it. I think it was really a highlight of the magazine world at a certain time.
Do you think it served a role for women specifically? Like, was there something that Glamour did that other magazines maybe weren't doing?
Well, I think that it looked at women holistically, right? There, it wasn't just fashion and beauty. There was politics. There was community issues. There was relationships. There were money, finances. You know, it really looked at women's lives through a very informed lens, not catering or speaking down to women, but actually telling them the things that they should know or they should care about, in addition to the things that they did care about.
So, Sumita, you're at the top of this, you know, little magazine called Teen Vogue, which has suddenly now become like the wokest of woke. But Teen Vogue made a similar transition that one of our callers was talking about, now going to digital only. Can you explain for us what was behind that decision?
Yeah, and just to kind of contextualize this was prior to my arriving a few months before at Teen Vogue. And, you know, part of this transition was really based on where Gen Z gets their news. And they don't really go to the store and pick up a magazine, right? Or they're not necessarily, you know, they might see it at the doctor's office, but it's not really the target audience, right? And millennials and younger, Gen Z, I would say, you know, they really get their news on Instagram.
So right? Who are Gen Z? Because I think everybody is now a millennial. Nobody knows. There's old millennials. There's young. Like, who is Gen Z first?
Gen Z is technically, I think, under 22.
Okay, got it. Okay.
So today's high school students. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I they are not as likely to pick up a magazine in the same way, right? Maybe a collector's issue they might be interested in or something that has a special value or, you know, something like that. But in general, they're getting their news from their phone. And, you know, I think the industry is kind of reflecting that transition.
So I want to ask both of you, other than like the obvious, which is age, like how has the demographic changed for women's magazines, or has the demographic changed? I mean, are teen girls still going to be teen girls and young, you know, older teenage? Like, what's exactly, is it a similar audience or a different audience? Vanessa?
I mean, I think that the audience is the same and some of the concerns and issues are the same. It's just how they are digesting that information is totally different. So you, as, you know, as someone who's in media, you have to be flexible. You have to be multi-platform. You have to be available wherever he is, because if you're not, then you're going to lose that audience. But I definitely think that the audience still cares about a lot of these issues. If they didn't, they wouldn't be engaging at all.
And Sumita, you guys have also, like I said, you're now like, I mean, no joke, Teen Vogue is considered super woke, super informative. Like, is that was a big editorial shift too.
It was a big editorial shift. And I would say, you know, it's not the audience, whether it's changed or not. I think that audiences have much higher standards about what they're going to see in the media. And young people especially, they want to see authentic portrayals, inclusive portrayals of their own lives and the stories that impact their lives. And that, you know, we have had to respond to that pressure, I think. And I believe it's a good pressure because it's further democratizing the types of images we're seeing in magazines and the types of stories that we're covering. To Vanessa's point, I actually think a lot of women's magazines have been doing that work without getting a lot of the credit. But what's often overshadowed that work is these kind of toxic visions of femininity that have perpetuated and kind of dominated the women's marketplace. And I don't actually blame the women's magazines in particular for that. I think that that's a market issue. I think that's an advertiser issue. And I think it's, you know, people trying to figure out funding models and things like that. So I do think that young people are just, they're more woke about this stuff, right? They don't want to see just, you know, kind of cisgender, you know, hetero, thin white models on the cover of their magazines.
I remember I read these magazines like any other young girl did, you know, 17 and YM and all that, except I was a brown girl with a big nose and broad lips and never saw myself. And then one day my mother bought a magazine named Sassy and said, look, I don't know what this is. Here's a cover with a girl that has a nose that looks like you. That was life changing for me. I became a subscriber right after that. Where are we today when it comes to women that look like the rest of us in magazines?
Yeah. So I was also a sassy girl. And
thank you.
One of the most exciting things about working in magazines today is the hope and kind of, I think, the interest for a platform like Sassy Again, where, you know, kind of like non-mainstream voices are heard and kind of pick, you know, images of women that we can relate to. And, you know, I think the marketplace has fractured so much. I think there are so many different places to get the types of media you want. But I actually think we are a little early in celebrating how much the industry has actually shifted in terms of relying on certain, you know, certain visions of beauty and certain kind of stereotypical ideas of what it looks like to be a woman. I mean, I think if you look at all the kind of most famous supermodels, they're still extremely skinny. They, you know, have a specific type of nose, specific type of hair. And while we are seeing more diverse images, often you have to go out and find them yourself. You have to be interested. Instagram, Tumblr, you know, and it's exciting to be Teen Vogue. We are very conscientious about that and kind of incorporating and elevating those voices. And I'd love to see more magazines doing that.
Vanessa, what about your experience in Essence with that? And this preeminent magazine for Black women in particular.
No, we know that representation matters, and the way that representation is shows up also matters. So we're talking about different hair textures, different skin tones, different ways of dressing, different ways of accessorizing, you know, just that personal style piece that you didn't necessarily see all the time in more of the mainstream publications. I mean, if at all, there would be maybe one image of a woman with curly hair, quote unquote curly hair.
And that's about as far as it went.
And that is really about as far as it went. So we understood at Essence how deeply important it was to make sure that we were hitting on all of the notes, because it matters. People want to be seen. People want to know that there is that their look, their style is being acknowledged and being celebrated, actually.
Are Black women looking for something specific in media that you think they're not getting today, particularly when it comes to magazines and this type of content?
I think it's a depth of understanding. You know, it's not enough to say this lipstick shade is great for this particular tone of brown, right? It's more an deeper understanding of how diverse we are, how diverse we truly are, and then delivering that message in a way that speaks to who we are as Black women. That has always been, I have felt, a challenge in mainstream publications. It's like they're paying lip service, literally, to what they think will appeal to a specific audience, but they're not necessarily going deeper and talking about some of the deeper issues that are surrounding how we feel about how we look and how society feels about how we look.
I think one of the things that comes up in that, and Samita, you're nodding your head, it's also the issue of feminism, right? Which is really easy to talk about today. I remember a dark time in the 90s when this was considered the other F word. Nobody wanted to say it. Nobody wanted to claim it. But today we can have this conversation about feminism. Are women's magazines tasked with some feminist message today that they weren't in the past, do you think?
Absolutely. I do think that there is an external pressure because most young women identify as feminist now. And, you know, Tenzina, you know, my background really does come from feminist media. And, you know, I was at Feministing for a very long time. And our interest and often our task was to hold mainstream media accountable for the way, not just how they were representing women, but how they were representing actual feminists, right? And I do think we're kind of at this tipping point. I mean, I think ever since Beyonce got on stage and claimed feminism, it became accessible to a broader audience, which is a good thing. That's what we want, right? And I do think that that pressure that's now put on magazines, that's good. That's only going to bring us stronger stories. It's only going to increase our understanding and I think spread, you know, feminism's message to a broader audience.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the idea that there are voices out there that should be heard, that are to be discovered, that are representing different points of view, that's a critical piece of pushing the culture forward, right? So it's so exciting to see that some of these more mainstream publications are mainstream brands are looking for those, seeking out those voices, giving them a platform on which to be heard. I wish they they would do more of it, a lot more of it. I wish they would dig even deeper, you know, just beyond just kind of like the surface people that you hear about or have a book out, or, I mean, really dig deep into some of these, you know, these nether regions of consciousness and bring those voices to the table. That would be even more exciting.
There's one other thing that women's magazines were known for back in the day, and I'm going to read an excerpt here from a 1955 edition of Good Housekeeping. The article was titled, or headlined, The Good Wife's Guide, just so we're all aware. I know, and eyeballs rolling in back of heads. Ready, ladies, it reads, have dinner ready. Touch up your makeup and don't complain if he's late home for dinner or even if he stays out all night. This is the 1955, ladies. Now, obviously, we've evolved somewhat, some would say, since then. But you can still pick up some magazines and find, you know, 57 ways to keep your man happy. I don't know. Is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? I mean, do we all have to have feminist women's magazines now? Or can we, is there a room for The Good Wife's Guide or The Good GF's Guide or whatever?
I mean, I think it's okay as long as there's balance. Well, I'm not okay with that article. Let's be clear. that I'm not okay with. That's crazy. But I do think that there's, you know, that just being a feminist doesn't mean that you don't embrace looking good and feeling good about yourself and empowering yourself in that way. It doesn't mean that at all. And I think we just have to make sure that there's enough balance there so that you're not putting emphasis on the superficial and, you know, and what's in front of you.
Samita, your thoughts on that?
You know, I think there's a piece of this that's really about meeting the audience where they're at, right? And you know, whether I agree or disagree, the reality is there's a percentage of women that do want information like that, right? And we kind of have to meet them where they are. And I do think it's important, you know, and something that I've really learned over the years is you don't want to alienate women based on certain choices. That doesn't mean you have to agree with everything they say. And I'm certainly not advocating for choice feminism or anything like that. But I do think that the reality is, you know, especially with teen girls, they have certain values and ideas about sex or about courtship. And who are we to kind of judge that? I think it's about giving them the information they need to make the decisions that are best for them.
Samita Mukhopadhyay is the executive editor of Teen Vogue, and Vanessa DeLuca was the editor-in-chief of Essence from 2013 to 2018. She's now the founder of TheEditorInChief.com, a new lifestyle platform. Thank you both for being with me.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
And thanks so much for listening to our show today. You can tweet us with your thoughts about pretty much anything at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.